Welcome to The Daisy Project, a podcast where we have meaningful conversations with entrepreneurs, leaders, and change makers on what it means to live a meaningful life and also on how they got to where they are now. Today, I'm with someone who I find incredibly inspiring. She's based in Chandigarh. She's a poet, an activist, and a teacher, and she's passionate about reclaiming public spaces with poetry and art. She's been featured in Tribune India, India Today, and spoken at TEDx Chandigarh. Her poetry is performed in Hindustani, which is a mix of Urdu and Hindi that I learned today, and in English. She's led many campaigns and is one of the leads in organizing the current anti-CAA protests in Chandigarh, which we'll be chatting about during this episode. So today's guest is the one and only Amy Singh.
Hi, Daisy.
Amy, so what? I've read that you do poetry in open spaces, in parking lots, in train stations, and in public spaces. Why do you choose to perform in these open spaces?
So first reason is that growing up in India as a woman, it is always somehow implied, or if not directly taught, that these kind of public spaces are unsafe for women, and which is a case also. I wouldn't say it's otherwise. A lot of times I have been harassed in these public spaces as well. So I wanted to sort of go out with a lot of, you know, intentions of love and communication and openness and see what happens. So it was like bearing yourself and emanating a lot of love and the intention of forming a human connection, which is just pure and in the moment, and see what happens if you are not operated by fear, but by the sense of connection, which is there. So what happens? So that was one. And the other was poetry for me has always been this art form which is most accessible and most relevant. But I've also seen that lately the poetry was sort of confined into the four walls of cafe or an auditorium or a room, as if it was some elite thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I had my issues with that elitism of poetry.
Even the literature space can be like that a lot, right?
Exactly.
Sometimes I feel in spaces where there's literature or literature awards, for me in Australia, I feel it's like a very elitist space to be in. And
absolutely.
So reclaiming it through doing it, your poetry and expressing your art in public spaces,
absolutely,
I guess enables you to connect. I love what you said about coming from a place of love rather than fear.
Yeah,
I'm curious, for the very first time that you organized to perform in a public space, how did you muster up the courage to do that, and what was that very first experience like?
So, you know, sometimes in life I'm so sure that I'm hearing something inside me, you know, calling out to me to do something, and even if my logical mind is absolutely debating it, I still know it in my gut that this is the right thing to do right now. Like it feels the most natural thing to be for me to be doing at that moment. And that's how it was. I was actually on a World Poetry Day, I think 4 years ago. I was seeing that there was no event, there was nothing happening. I was like, it's World Poetry Day. It's like I want to observe it, and what do I do? And the most natural thing that came to my mind was just go out and read poems to people, that's all, and maybe ask them to read some poetry to you. So I went to Sector 17 Plaza, and outside this small little bookstore called Asia Book House, I just started reading some poems, and people stopped and they read poetry back to me, and I had like the most magical evening of my life. I mean, the kind of joy that I had not even felt while reading poetry from much renowned stages, you know. So I thought, okay, this is something that I want to explore. I always knew that poetry belonged to people and into public spaces, but I never really understood how. And that was like a cue that I picked up on. And then the first time I formally organized a poetry reading in public spaces, I don't know if it was a very courageous thing. It was risky, yes, especially in Chandigarh, where you need a lot of permissions in order to be doing something in the public spaces. I just went there with an openness that come what may, whatever, you know, at max, we would not be able to pull it off. That's the maximum, you know. Or someone would say some nasty stuff to me. Well, what else? What else, you know, there can be. So with that openness, I just went there. But what I discovered instead was a lot of acceptance, participation. And it just grew and grew. And within now, like in 3-4 years, we have become like a big community of poets and listeners who are always found in public parks, you know, reading and listening to poetry of each other.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. I love how, you know, when you were considering doing it, the first thing is like you went to, you know, one is coming from a place of love, but also what is the worst possible outcome?
Yeah.
So often when we go to do new projects, we're sort of anxious about the results, we're scared to do them, we let fear kind of rob us of this experience of expression, when the worst possible thing that could happen isn't so bad after all, right?
Yeah, I think one of the writers, I'm forgetting the name, said that reality is kinder than your expectations sometimes, and I have found it to be the case many times, because I believe it's human nature to perceive fear and be so stuck in that fear. It comes naturally because, you know, it's in our DNA. We have to, you know, protect ourselves and survive and thrive as a species. So that's there. But then what is the most surprising factor is that we don't expect goodness in the same depth and amount that we expect bad things to happen. And that is, if life has taught me anything, it is that goodness surprises you. It has surprised me so many times that I'm always now seeking that, nothing else. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
So how is it that you use your poetry to pursue activism? And has your poetry always been about activism, or how has that emerged in the current context?
So, you know, I started writing poetry when I was probably 6 or 7 years old. And if I remember correctly, it was probably someone plucking a flower from the plant. And I just thought, ouch, the plant might have felt hurt or stolen from or something. And I wanted to, I don't know, it almost happened naturally, like as if I was just breathing and I had a poem come out of me on that observation. So poetry, I never thought that, oh, I'm going to use my poetry to express love or to tell a story or, you know, to protest or to do an activism. I think whatever I am and whatever I feel, the most genuine, authentic expression that comes out of me for that particular incident as a response is poetry, is a poem. And most of times I don't understand how am I dealing with stuff or what I want from life or a particular incident unless I have written a poem about it. So poetry is my way of, you can say, navigating through life. So whatever moves me, it could be a social issue that I feel strongly about, or it could be, you know, a social thing that I have to protest against, whatever. When I feel so moved that there's a lot of emotion that rises inside me, that's where I think my poetry takes birth.
Yeah. And I love how you, we're going to get into that a little more, but how you've used it in the current climate to bring people together and how you've used it for the protest, which we'll get into in a second. But so you said what inspired you. You said you started this when you were quite young. Are there other poets or people along the way that have inspired you to start sharing it more frequently?
So for most of my life, I wrote it for myself. Like I was not a shy child, but I was shy about my poetry because I thought it was too personal. It was like letting someone have a gaze in my mind of who I am, and you're not sure if you want everybody to know you so intimately. So I would dance on the stages and I would sing songs, but to read my poetry out loud was always a big fear, I would say. I wouldn't want people to read my poems. Only my mother and some close friends, I would read my poetry to them. But I think after I had a concussion, something changed. I always find myself, you know, connecting the dots and seeing that after I had my concussion, something just changed. It was in the middle of 2015. And after that, you know, I was in a relationship, a beautiful relationship. And my partner was very encouraging at that time that you should, you know, why don't you read your poems to people? I think people would find a lot of comfort and resonance with your words, and you must go. And one of these days, I signed up for a poetry reading, not knowing there was a competition. So when I arrived there, it turned out to be a slam, and I was like, oh, I don't have those feelings about poetry. I don't think poetry can be a part of, like, how do you put poetry and competition together? Like, it felt very unnatural. But since I had shown up there, I thought, okay, I'll go through it. And I won the first prize in that slam. And after that, so many people walked to me saying that they felt something while listening to that poem, that my word made them feel in a certain way or answered some of their questions, this and that.
How do you decide? You said something there about it was too personal to me.
Yeah.
And I feel a lot of people, whether they're expressing themselves through poetry, through blogging, through videoing, through vlogging, whatever it is that they're doing to express themselves through art, how do you decide whether, okay, this one is just for me and this one is for sharing? Do you know what I mean? Like, how, this is something I battle with a lot, is how much do you decide is comfortable to share?
Yeah.
And do you have a rule of thumb, or have you become a complete open book at the moment? Like, how do you decide that this is, I'm okay to share this, or this one's just for me?
A few years ago, I met London's poet laureate, Selina Nwulu, and I was having the same conversation with Selina because her poetry seemed to be, you know, something that was coming out from deeply personal spaces. And I literally had tears in my eyes while listening to some of her poetry while she was reading here at the British Library. And I, after my conversation, like after her performance, I was having this conversation and I asked her the same thing, like, you know, that I'm struggling with this bit that, well, how do you do it? Like, share something so personal and so openly. And she said, you know, there is a thin line between personal and private. So all that's personal can be put out there. But what's private, you have all the rights to preserve it for yourself or for some handful of people that you can trust it with. And I think that just gave me a lot of clarity.
How do you decide what's personal and what's private? I'm putting you on the spot here. These
were not... I think what it is for me might not be the same for you. But I think a lot of our personal experiences are also universal experiences. Say, heartbreak. Okay? And or say, issues with parents, or issues such as, or an experience such as, you know, mourning a dead pet. So a lot of us... As it is very personal, and at the same time, it's quite universal because we are humans, and we. So when I talk about my personal, I do not give away details of other people involved in that incident, or I do not speak for them without their permission. But I still share my side of my experiential side of that whole experience, you know. So that is my thin line between the personal and private. That whatever I went through or I felt, I have all the rights to put it out there in as much authenticity as possible. But if it is linked to something that I'm still figuring out myself within myself, or it involves other people or experiences that I can't share, then I don't share. Yeah.
Okay. So personal and private. And if it's something that involves other people, then you sort of, you share the part that is universal.
As
opposed to sharing what's theirs, not claiming that.
Absolutely. Like, I could talk about what I'm feeling, how I'm feeling, you know, say I've had a fight with my father. I can absolutely write a poem, and I have written a poem where I'm talking about how I feel. Okay. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I have to, you know, like step by step, recite the incident. Okay, that what exactly happened. I don't have to talk about that,
or
because that's
allocate blame or point fingers.
Yeah, point fingers or
expressing what you feel.
Exactly, like there doesn't have to be a deliberate detail of the incident. What matters is your experience and what you learned from it. And while, so see, some poetry sometimes is finding answers. Sometimes it's finding a vent. you're feeling so much, you have to release that. And you don't know, so, like, because you're a poet or a writer, the most natural thing for you to do is just pick up a pen and pencil and start writing how you're feeling. And that then in a lot of ways is an emotional release, you know, venting out. So sometimes a poem is just that. And you might not even want to share it with anyone later.
It's just for you.
Yeah, but when you do, a lot of people can relate with it. Mm. And you don't have to mention what happened. You just have to write about how did you navigate through it?
Yeah.
How did you, you know, came out of it?
And yeah.
Or while you were in it, how were you feeling? Mm-hmm. So it is about your authenticity, you know, your experience that drives other people in.
Speaking of that, I know you've had some tumultuous experiences in your life at different stages.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what were some of those or one or two of the low experiences and how did you emerge from them?
So, you know, I think, again, what I've gone through is, again, quite universal. I think all of us go through many of them. Many of the humans that we know have gone through it. So I don't say that, you know, it was something too bad that happened to me only. It happens to everyone. But how each one of us processes that is different. And for me, the lowest low moments of my life could be one of the biggest, I think, could be my mom's death, like when she passed away. And before she passed away, there was a 4 or 5 years long battle with cancer, very traumatic period of my life. Also getting myself into an abusive relationship, getting married and then, you know, struggling to come out of it and going through this a divorce, which is such a stigmatic issue.
Especially here in Punjab,
in India. India, yes.
People stick out abusive relationships for a lot longer than they should.
Yeah.
Because of the stigma of divorce and the stigma of that.
Absolutely. So to in going through that and you know, so you grow up a lot while dealing with this. See, nobody in the school teaches you what to do if your mother passes away, okay? Nobody teaches you how to deal with an abusive partner and when to walk out or even how to read the red flags. This is not the kind of education that you get in schools and all of these issues are quite a stigma to be discussed in the families or in the dining room conversations. You know, people shy away from it. And
how to deal with grief.
How to deal with grief or loss.
Suffering and pain.
Or, you know, how to survive it and how to come out of it, you know, how to say no. So there's these simple things that there was no one around, and especially I was only 16 when my mom passed away. So I think a lot of these things I had to learn by myself. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a hand that I could hold and just walk. So life became my teacher in a way, mm-hmm. which is not to say that my father or my siblings weren't there. They were. But I think the things which you got to learn are not the things which someone else can anyway teach you. Mm-hmm. It's you trying to figure it all out, experiencing, mm-hmm. having that openness, getting up after every knock, you know, and still holding your head up and saying, okay, it's okay. I can see through this. I'll come out of this. It's fine. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
So, yes. And then going through post-traumatic stress disorder was emotionally the lowest, I think, which was a result of my abusive relationship, you know. So coming up, so I realized that if you're physically low, you find a lot of support and you also kinder to yourself. You'll be like, oh, there's a wound, I have to nurse it. Or, oh, I've broken my bone, I have to, you know, keep my foot still and eat healthy and get better. But when you are going through an invisible traumatic experience, which cannot be seen, is not tangible, you know, you are first harder on yourself because you have no idea how to go through this. Again, nobody teaches us how to deal with depression or anxiety. And then the support outside gets very limited as well, because you don't know what you're doing and you don't have that clarity. Even the people who are your support system and caregivers, even they have been brought up in the same system. Even they don't know how to support you. So it's a pretty challenging situation. That is why mental health is, again, one thing that I've always felt that I have to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I have to bring awareness around it. My TEDx talk was about concussions, and concussion again is an experience which is not dealt very healthily when it comes to a human connection So in a concussion, a lot of times things don't show up in the reports, and you have to like depend on your patient's feedback, mm-hmm. about and then map their recovery. But that is very difficult, because as doctors also, you're just taught to look at the reports and not look at the patient, you know. Yeah. So a lot of these things, while I was going through, I always questioned that now I went through this terrible experience and I have learned certain things. What do I do with this learning? Can I make it easier for someone else, you know, who's going to go through it or is probably going through it? Can I show them some map that I did not have for myself?
This is something that I really deeply admire about you. I've been in workshops where I've been facilitating or even taking part amongst a lot of Punjabi women or South Asian women in Australia as well. And I started to notice a pattern where a lot of the problems they face are quite personal problems, things like, how do I get my parents to approve of my partner? Mm. They're of a different faith, or they're of a different caste, or things like this. Or I want to go study in a city that is far away, my parents will never approve. Mm. Or I don't want to get married and my parents are forcing me to get married. And this is a constant. And it's not that I was surprised about this, because I feel like I went through similar things when I moved out of home and ran away, and my parents disowned me twice or three times every time I made a decision to dye my hair green or get a boyfriend. But one of the things I noticed is when I was in these spaces, I was thinking of more community issues, and I was thinking, well, where is the passion and where is the energy for this? And then I realized, wow, I think I'm in a community right now in a space where there's still healing to be done at a personal level.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of pressure at the same time to do both. Mm. But I think I've watched you do both, and to be quite committed to your own personal healing.
Yeah.
But also to what's going around in what's happening in society right now, and to show up in the way that you show up, to lead and to be involved and to express and not to be. Because so many people say, okay, I'm going through this. I have an abusive partner, or this is happening. And then they block off the external world entirely. Yeah. I don't want to be involved in politics, or I don't want to be involved in this. So I think there's a few campaigns that I've got here that I wanted to chat to you about, maybe starting off on the slightly lighter topics before we get to the CAA. I found out from a mutual friend recently, everyone in Chandigarh knows Amy. I must mention that. No matter where you go, Amy, yes, she is Chandigarh's sweetheart. She's Chandigarh's activist. She's Chandigarh's poet. So she's quite well known everywhere I've
loved.
Gone.
I don't know well known, but I'm deeply loved. That much I know. Yes.
She's deeply loved by those who know her, and it seems to me that every second person I meet knows her. So she may deny this. But someone recently mentioned to me that you were involved in the campaign around changing the name of Gehri Root to Azadi Root on Google Maps, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So I guess some context, and Amy, I'll get you to give some more context. From my understanding is Punjabi pop music culture is huge. Anyone that's seen the film Urda Punjab knows about that, or even if you're from here, the Punjabi music culture is huge. And Gehri Root has been an area where people go for a drive and they go to drive around there, and it started off from what I understand to be something quite harmless. But later on it became defined by going around for a drive to hassle young boys, going to drive around to hassle women, to whistle at them, and to pretty much go on a drive to check out women without their permission. And this became a thing to do, and this is what pop culture started to perpetuate.
Yes.
And this was even on Google Maps. It was called Gehri Root, right?
Yes, yes.
So I want you to talk a little more about that campaign and how you managed, why it was problematic, and then how you managed to change the name.
So there was a stalking incident, Varnika Kundu's stalking incident that happened in Chandigarh. And that was not a solitary incident. There was a gang rape that was that happened in Sector 36. And there was a young 10-year-old girl who was impregnated by an uncle. Wow. And then there was a girl who was in the broad daylight raped in children's traffic park in Chandigarh. So there were quite a few incidents in and around Chandigarh, which was shocking, because I grew up in the city and I always felt that Chandigarh was the safest place for me. I cannot say that about Delhi or some other cities that I've been to, but in Chandigarh I always felt safe. Growing up here, is even on the Gedi route, I felt safe. But that was not the case in past few years.
Where is the Gedi route? It's in...
It's the Sector 8, 9, 10, 11. So there are a lot of colleges and eateries. So there's a whole route I can show you on the Google map. Or maybe I can take you there for a drive on Azadi route.
the reclaimed space, Azadi route.
Exactly. So yes, I thought... So we took out a march as a protest. It was a midnight march called Bake Off Azadi March. So Bake Off is the word for fearless. And Azadi is freedom. So we were saying that it's not that we are not free. We are free. But we are not fearless in that freedom. So even when we are out there on the roads at night, we are fearful. The idea is that we shouldn't feel that fear. So we marched from Rose Garden to Sector 10 Arts College, which is part of the Gedi route, then Gedi route, and now Azadi route. So we marched. It was a march led by women, but was joined by a lot of men as well. And there was pretty successful campaigning. And then Deepsa Vivekanand, who's a friend and who's also a part of the Bake Off Azadi March, then started this petition to change the name. Mm-hmm. And it got enough signatures and it was verified through news articles and everything. So the name got changed. And it was a very symbolic victory. In no manner I say that everything else, you know, just changed with changing the name on the road. No, yeah. It is still an ongoing process. But that's the thing. I believe you were saying that, you know, I'm able to concentrate on my own healing as well as I'm able to, you know, stand up for the causes outside. That is because I have understood that I'm part of an ecosystem. It's like how nature works. Everything is connected to another thing. It's whether me going out there standing up for a cause or me, you know, cooking a meal for myself because I need to nourish myself. It's all part of one ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So for me, I see that oneness. I don't see that difference. Maybe that's why I'm able to, you know, stand up like I am able to. And with the Gedi route being changed to Azadi route, the only thing that happened was that people suddenly saw possibility of reclaiming, you know, a pop culture which is misogynist. So Punjabi songs, Punjabi music, and the whole notion of Gedi. I mean, nobody minds if you're just driving around and looking at, you know, people or your surroundings, and as long as it's harmless. But when you start, you know, calling names and you start honking horns or you start, you know, throwing used condoms at people, that then it gets dangerous and misogynist and outrightly unacceptable thing to do. Mm-hmm. That's when you got to reclaim it. So you start with small reclamations. So maybe a name first. Yeah. And then you work on the whole process. That's not the end result. That's very... you know, first or second step in the process. Yes. So that is what I feel about the Azadi route. And it's such a joy to listen to when you are in the Uber or, you know, when you are in the cab and says, turn left onto the Azadi route.
That's like, amazing. Wow. Yeah, it's like, wow, we actually had a part in changing that. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
One of the other things I want to discuss with you that you just mentioned is like Punjabi pop music. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess the older I've gotten and the more aware of any wisdom I've acquired, now I've started to ask a lot more questions about what I consume. And I love Punjabi music. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when I dig deeper into these lyrics, I find them quite troublesome. Mm-hmm. I find that I am listening to music that is talking about caste. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the song, what is it, Luck 28, Weird 48, that song, right? Yeah. It plays at every wedding. And the translation of this song is that it measures the ideal woman, that she weighs 48 kilos and her waist is this size. And I just sit there thinking, you know, we all get at weddings and we jump up and we dance to this song.
Yes.
And really, we don't really dance to the lyrics. We're dancing to the beat music, of it, the music of it. And I struggle to find like a clean Punjabi list. Like you can find clean music, but I look at it and I think, well, how is this influencing culture? Because I listen to this without without too much I listen to this and the meaning of it to me, I don't want to condone the meaning of this in any way. So, but in Punjab at the moment, I understand a lot of the music at the moment has become like this. I was reading recently the chief officer for women, I think she sued one of the singers and then she for objectifying women in his music. And then he was managed to send death threats to the minister for women, from what I understand.
Yeah.
So in your experience, I want to know, what influence do you think this music has? And do you think it's exaggerated that, or is it an expression that they're allowed to have? I'm curious about your thoughts on this.
So I think creative expression is, of course, I stand for it. I mean, even if I do not agree with it, I would stand for your right to express what you want to express. But at the same time, I also feel that I work with young kids and I manage a library at my school. So I have to be very conscious about the books that I add to the shelves, which, you know, say are accessible to 6-year-old kids or then to 10-year-old kids and then to 15-year-old kids. You have to be aware and conscious about what do you introduce to your child when. That's very significantly important. So when young kids, as young as say 5 years, 6 years old, are listening to misogynist songs, which are like all about jat, 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 caste, 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 and, you know, chal dai takka sita kar de, you know, and all these lyrics. And so you grow up with your mind is conditioned to believe that because you're a jat, you're superior. Or if it's a woman, you can just, you know, thrash them and hit them, or you can, if you're doing drugs or if you're into alcohol, that's quite nice, that's a cool thing to do. I mean, those are not the songs which a child should be listening to growing up. And as consumers, we have to be responsible. So one can have any kind of a creative expression, but as consumers, how mindful are we? When I'm hosting a party, can I just leave those songs out? Or if my kids or, you know, my nieces and nephews are to perform on a dance, can I give them better options? Because these songs becoming a pop culture is what's problematic. And we make them popular. So it is not that I'm accusing the creators of those kind of musics and song to be the only one responsible here. We consume it. So we can't control them. Like, what songs can they come up with? What can but we reject and diffuse?
The popularity of their music is that the community resonates or believes in what they're saying to be true.
Do we really? You just said that with you, it is a simple thing that you're just dancing to the beats, and so many times you're not even paying attention to the lyrics. All I'm saying is that we as consumers have to be a little more mindful about this fact that, okay, if I am I want nice music, can I also be careful about the lyrics, especially when they're people who are in an impressionable age around you, so that they don't grow up to be these kind of, you know, people who are discriminatory, misogynist, you know?
Yeah.
So we are trying to raise a healthy and better kids, you know, with sound minds and beliefs and ethics. So we have to be very careful about what kind of cinema songs they have access to and at what age. Not everything is relevant at every age. So you have to be a little careful about that.
And what about yourself? Do you listen to, do you have this conflict when you hear this music that you grew up around or your friends listen to or the community listens to, but the lyrics are contentious, or do you just avoid that entirely?
Yes. So see, when say a friend or a sibling is listening to the kind of music I have an issue with, I voice my issue and I also give reasons why my in opposition to this. But I don't, like, you know, turn it off. Mm-hmm. I walk out the room and I tell them why am I walking out or why I can't take it. But I never take away their right to explore it. I mean, they have to come to their own understanding that if they choose to reject it, why? Mm-hmm. This can't be because I am rejecting it or I said so, because that would not be a sustainable rejection. They would fall into even more problematic.
Exactly, when you're forced to not listen to something that's not the solution, you've got to come to your own conclusion.
And alternative music. Like if I have an issue with certain kind of, so say lyrics, am I coming up with mindful words in my poetry? And then I see so many people doing so, like Amrinder Gill. And then there's this whole new, so Sartaj's music is so clean and nice. And now there's a whole, a movement called Jive Punjab. Mm-hmm. So they're reviving the traditional folk Punjabi music, you know, as an alternative to what we say that we don't have an option. The pop culture is just pop culture and it's just there. And what do? So they are creating an alternative. Wow. So all of these initiatives need to be supported and we need to be participated in so that we can consciously remove the kind of music that we don't like from our
lives. I think that's so wonderful to hear these new initiatives to sort of bring that music back to life. So other than Gheri Route to Azadi Route, campaign, you've been involved in other campaigns, or you've spearheaded other campaigns. One of the recent ones last year that was featured in Indian newspapers was a Letters to Lahore, the Dark Initiative.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us a little more about that one?
So again, this was a very personal thing. I've always felt this, kitsch is a Punjabi word, when you're drawn to something. For Lahore, even the mention of the name Lahore, or if I read it somewhere, something inside me just moves. And I've been writing letters to Lahore for 4 years now. Like say I'm traveling and I'll pick up a postcard, which is another thing that I do. I write postcards and I write letters. So I would send one to GPO Lahore. Just like, hey,
what's
Lahore?
GPO Lahore?
That's a general post office.
Okay.
So I would just send it because I don't know anyone in, I did not know anyone in Lahore back then.
So just for context for some of my Australian folks who are listening. So Lahore is the capital of Punjab in Pakistan. And Chandigarh, where we're based right now, is the capital of Punjab.
Yes.
In India. It used to be one Punjab. So there's two Punjabs in two countries. It used to be one and it's been divided for some
time. I think in Punjabi people's heart, Punjab is still undivided. I mean, you can just feel it. So last year I started this campaign saying that I write letters to Lahore. Why don't you all also write letters of commonalities, brotherhood, harmony, peace, love across the border, and let's promote, you know, this cross-border peace and harmony, especially in the times when there's a lot of tension going on between two nations. And this campaign became viral again, and people start getting connected with each other, started writing letters, the school kids started writing letters, you know, university students started writing letters to another university there. So this just started the whole movement, and it became too big and something that I didn't know what it would turn into. And then again, I was a bit overwhelmed, like, how do I manage that? And then I realized that it's not for me to manage at all. I was just a catalyst. I'm not leading it anywhere. It will evolve, you know, as life wants it. Mm-hmm. And that's all.
Mm-hmm. And how many letters ended up being sent?
I wouldn't have the count, but yes, I'm writing, so many other people are writing. And in the beginning I said I did not know anyone in Lahore back then, but then I have received so many letters, so many words, so many people. And now they have also given me the addresses that you can write to us. And we write you back, and we have become like pen pals.
Wow, that's amazing.
And not just me, so many people who participated in the initiative, like that. Wow.
So most recently, or at the moment while I'm down visiting, I guess, you've been focusing on the Anti-Citizenship Amendment Act protests, but also sharing your poetry in spaces to talk about this. I actually went along with Amy a few days ago to one of the universities where it was quite beautiful to see, but as students had organized a gathering around sharing art and poetry and expressions in light of the situation in India. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the situation and what you're doing here in Chandigarh?
Yes. So it's not just me. I always believe that anything, especially the CANRC, it's a people's movement, and a lot of people are spearheading it in different ways, from wherever they're stationed in their lives and with whatever skills and art they have inside them, they are sort of, putting it all together and turning it into a larger national action against CA and RC. So I'm doing my bit, I would say, whether it is organizing a protest or reading my poems, which is again my way of protest, majorly.
Yeah. So just for some context, the CA Citizenship Amendment Bill.
Act. It's an act now. So Citizenship Amendment.
It's an act now, so it's, yeah, yeah. It's been passed.
So Citizenship Amendment Act says that it will give refugees Indian citizenship from India. From Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh to persecuted minorities, but it leaves out Muslims, Sri Lankan Tamilians, and many other minorities. So basically, you can see that there is a discrimination on the basis of religion, Muslim religion to be specific. But CA, when you link it with NRC, which is National Registry of Citizenship, what that means is that everybody who cannot provide, anybody who's in India, has been in India and cannot provide certain documents, their citizenship would be questioned as well. So it's not just about giving some persecuted, selected persecuted minority citizenship. It's also about taking away citizenship from a lot of people. So that is not just limited to Muslims. The problematic part is that it is, in its very nature, an anti-poor act. Mm-hmm. So that is why we are fighting against it, because if we are so inclusive, why are we not talking about accepting Shia or Ahmadiyyas or Rohingya Muslims in that mm-hmm. sense? So a lot of, so there's a whole context, and I would invite all the listeners to do some readings and inform themselves about the context deeply, because we would need another 1 hour long podcast session to go into the
details.
And it's
quite concerning, I guess, India as a historically a secular country.
Yeah. So this goes against the very fabric of our secularism and the very fundamental right of equality, So that's why there is such an outrage on the national level. So everywhere, people are standing against it. The states are moving the central government to the courts for this. So they are held responsible and they are asked questions, though they're not responding, and they're saying that they will not even move an inch back. But that's such an arrogance for an elected government. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you move an inch when the people who elected you are questioning you and are not willing to walk with you? Mm-hmm. What kind of arrogance is that? Mm-hmm. So yes, let's
see. So what's being organized in Chandigarh at the moment?
There have been rallies. There have been ongoing protests probably every alternative day. Someone or the other is, group is coming together. Some are protesting through their art. Some are protesting through their poems. Some are, protesting by sitting in a sit-in sort of a protest mm-hmm. with placards and, charts and with messages and words. So, yes, that's what's happening in Chandigarh. And whatever happens in Chandigarh will keep on strengthening the nationwide campaign against the CA and RC in complete solidarity. We, the people of India, against this discriminatory, oppressive, fascist regime that we have accidentally mm-hmm. elected.
Accidentally elected. Wow. Wow. No, I think what all the work you're doing here is so needed. And as like a young female who's spearheading involved, I know you always say, I'm just involved. But you're very, very involved in all the organizing committees. And I think that's so impressive. And it's so inspiring that you act on being involved in defining what happens around you, rather than at a time like this, not getting involved. You put yourself at some risk as well with some of the cases that's happened in India, but yet you still step outside.
Of course. I mean, whenever you stand up in life to anything, so, whether it was standing up to, say, a moment of grief or an abuse that you've gone through, or a very physical injury such as concussion, or it is standing up to your elected government for the decisions which are discriminatory and non-secular and non-democratic, I think the essence of it is very personal, which is, and it's very true that if I don't do what I do, I am not able to, I'm not at peace with myself, with who I am. So I don't see any other way. Mm-hmm. So there is risk, of course, but I don't want that kind of safety at the cost of my ethics.
Wow.
I would rather be risked than, mm-hmm. you know, be safe in this environment. I don't want to hide. I don't want to stay mum.
If that's not courage, I don't know what courage is. On that note, I was hoping that you might share some of your poetry with us to wrap up this episode.
Probably you can, on a lighter note.
Yes, on a lighter note is fine. You choose. You could pick something on a lighter note. You pick something you've been reading lately. It's up to you. You can choose English or Punjabi or Hindustani, as long as I might get you to translate if you opt for the latter.
Yeah.
But I think the way Amy reads her poetry, and her poetry is so wonderful, that it would be such a beautiful moment for us if you could share.
I would have loved to read the Hindustani poem, but then I know that it will be lost because of lack of translation. So I would go ahead and read in English a poem. Okay. There's a little bit of context. Once upon a time, there was a friend visiting, and he said, "Oh, I'm never going to date a poet." And I was like, "Why? What's wrong dating a poet?" And he said, "They take everything so seriously. Goddamn, they take sunflowers seriously. Who takes sunflowers seriously?" And he laughed, and I laughed. But after he left, I was kind of in reaction, and I wrote this poem, which I'm going to read.
You wrote a poem about a friend who said you were too serious about poetry.
Not about a friend, about what he said.
About what he said. Okay, let's hear it.
So it goes like, someone said, "Who takes sunflowers seriously? I take sunflowers seriously. Rain has my earnest attention. Some days my feet sink a little deeper in earth and I feel planted. Maybe that's why I talk to the trees like they are my siblings. I borrow sunset colors from the sky, brew them in my tea, drink it like a miracle cure for the diseases I do not have but carry. My houseplants will show you the state of my soul. Ask me about joy. Ask me about joy and I'll read you a poem. Hold me in your arms and see how letting go works or doesn't. My lungs have more songs than air in them, and I know grief like I know my own hands. Everything I touch sometimes turn a little sad. It's a blessing moon is out of my reach. Like love, I am mostly in the air. But when I'm not, I try to find myself. I have late night conversations with Khalil Gibran. I see Vincent and Sylvia laughing in the field my soul longs for. Rumi tells me, you are the field. But love is ineffable in its expression. And Hemingway's suicide note isn't a biblical verse. And Guru Gobind crossing the Sarsa River seems like an act of romance to me. So I romance life. And maybe death too. I send postcards to faraway places and write letters I have no addresses for. I negate myself often and then I negate that negation. I question Marx for the whole process. He doesn't seem to mind that, but my comrades do. So I give them answers that I don't owe them, like this poem, and then I judge them as harshly as I judge myself, and I wonder, why do I live in reaction? Why don't I have any faith or wisdom or beauty in the simple fact that I exist? Sometimes I almost believe that I'm made up of noise. But then a great silence submerges me like a deep river. That's where I find God, or a new kind of poem. I become silent even in my speech. Like sunsets are in their glory, like river is in its story, like rain is in its thunder, like love is in its wonder, like I am when I take the sunflower seriously, like I'm not while writing this poem.
That is so beautiful.
Thank you, Daisy.
Thank you so much for sharing. And thank you for everything you're doing at the moment and standing up for what counts and what matters.
Thank you so much for supporting me and for having me on this podcast. And I wish you all the best.
And how can people connect with you if they want to connect with you to support your work or to follow your poetry or to join your protests?
Social media, Amy Singh Writes.
So Amy Singh Writes.
Yes.
Okay. Amy Singh. And that's on Instagram.
Yes, that's on Instagram. It's on Facebook.
Instagram both. And Facebook. Yes. The best way. So it's Amy Singh Writes, folks. If you're a local and you want to be involved in what she's spearheading, I encourage you to connect with Amy on Instagram or on Facebook. If you're not local here, do check out her poetry as you've had the pleasure of listening to it. It's absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much for tuning in.